all the controls on this remote unit, the volume is fully variable. Should the telephone ring or guests arrive,
very well. It's my pleasure to announce our guest lecturer. Pleased to announce Anders Perner, who is a senior staff specialist and professor in intensive care at Rikshospitalet, University of Copenhagen, and he's also an honorary professor of the George Institute in Sydney, Australia. His main focus is on clinical research in critically ill patients, and he chairs the Danish National Center for Research in Intensive Care and the Scandinavian Critical Care Trials Group. He was the chair of two landmark studies, the 6S and the TRIS trial, the results of which have improved fluid and transfusion therapy for patients with sepsis. His ongoing research continues along this track, testing frequent interventions given to critically ill patients, for which there are conflicting results about the balance between benefit and harm. And the ongoing clinical research programs involve currently the classic sub-ICU, AID-ICU, and hot-ICU trials. Please welcome Anders Perner.
Thanks, Christian. Thanks, Lars, Ian, for the invite. Once I get this on, I'll shut my mouth until it's there. Thank you. Great pleasure being here. Once again, thanks for the invite. As said, we test current interventions given to thousands and thousands of patients. And I'm to talk about one of them and hopefully discuss with you, first of all, why we give fluids, and then discuss a large trial on potential new way to give fluid therapy for patients with sepsis. I have a few conflicts of interest in this area. We receive funds for research from Fresenius Kabi and CSL Behring, and also Behring from Sumcom. First, to remind you, this is a drug. I'm not sure that we have had this in the forehead of our mind for many years, but now it should be there. IV fluids are drugs. They have effects, obviously. We try to utilize that every day, but there are now well-established side effects, including association with mortality of high fluid volumes, and also dysnatremias, which in particular intensive care are quite frequent, are associated with mortality, and the majority of the dysnatremias are produced by us. So potential iatrogenic harm caused by a very frequent intervention. So it's actually the perfect match to do a large trial program assessing benefits and harms of IV fluids. And the rhetoric questions, do we give IV fluids? Obviously we give a lot, and we give many different types. The latest figure I could found was from our classic septic shock trial, which I'll present in a minute. There, the two groups combined received median 18 liters of fluid during their ICU stay. So yes, we do give intravenous fluids. This talk will be a bit about history of IV fluids, a discussion of why we give fluids. I'll present data on lower versus higher fluid volumes, crystalloids versus colloids, saline versus buffered crystalloid solutions, and finally discuss what should we do And I sense that this is an eager group to discuss, so I hope you will do that with me. You may know this this story. I've just reread it, and there are new bits and pieces in this story that is really interesting. There was remarks about the surgeons taking care of IV fluid therapies already back then, and it didn't went well, I can say that. So the main characters, or the main fathers of IV fluid therapies, was an Irish man, Shaughnessy, and then a British doctor, Thomas Latte. Shaughnessy was very interested in biochemistry, and as a very young biochemist, he took samples from patients with severe cholera, and he wrote several pieces in the Lancet. This is a quote from one of them: "The blood drawn in the worst cases is unchanged in its anatomical and global structure. It has lost large amounts of its water. It has also lost a great proportion of its natural saline ingredients." So this was a time when blood leaching, enemas, and vomiting, inducing vomiting, was the standard therapy for malignant cholera. He went on, all the salts deficient in the blood, especially the carbonate of soda, are presented in a large quantity of peculiar white dejected matter. So that's the profuse watery diarrhea caused by cholera. So he made the biochemical rationale for IV saline for these patients by measuring the deficiency in the blood and describing that it was likely dejected in the stools and therefore deficient. It was then Dr. Thomas Latta who took this hypothesis into therapy, published the first reports in the Lancet here on relative to the treatment of cholera by copious injections of aqueous and saline fluids into the veins. There's a very fine description in a later paper in Lancet describing this story. To some latter of this place, is his due merits of first having recourse to this practice. He has tried in 6 cases. The most wonderful and satisfactory effect is the immediate result of the injection. A large quantity must be injected, from 5 to 10 pounds, in an adult, and repeated at longer or shorter intervals as the state of the pulse and other symptoms may indicate. He could have written the surviving sepsis campaign guideline. So, IV fluid therapy was then, over time, the first cholera, the polar pandemic disappeared, and the therapy was actually forgotten, and then re-emerged as a obviously standard intervention for patients with obvious fluid loss. Here, a case of cholera from Haiti in recent years. And IV fluid therapy for, again, obvious loss became very big under the World Wars, with the more advanced substitution of blood products and colloids given, again, on presumed loss of blood volume. But other indications came to this. This is just a protocol for IV fluid therapy for major surgery in the 80s. In the bottom there are, again, fluids given for presumed loss, fasting, and blood loss. And that's, I guess, fits with the initial thought. But now new concepts emerge. So now there's fluid given for no loss of blood volume. For instance, 500 milliliters of starch preloading of epidural anesthesia, so no loss, but fluid given. And this concept of third space losses, I'm old enough to remember that we, for every hour during open abdominal surgery, gave a certain amount of fluid because of this so-called third spacing. No one had ever seen third spacing, but it was just a concept that we had thought, giving fluid which hasn't been documented to be lost. So a new concept. And I think that That has been with us for quite some time and probably is with us. So I've tried here to list the what I think are the most frequent indications for IV fluid therapy given to critically ill. Circulatory impairment, obvious loss, of course, bleeding and ascites, for instance. We give fluid for presumed deficits, could be water or electrolytes, if we want forced diuresis. And some may give fluid for maintenance, meaning that if you cannot drink yourself, you need the water that you would otherwise drink. I'll go through the first bullet in detail and discuss a bit about the other indications. So why do we give fluid for circulatory impairment if the patient has lost fluid? The physiological model that prevails still is this, the Frank-Starling law of the left heart. I think still is in the center of why we give fluid for shock. If you ask it a bit different, so why do clinicians give fluid, so on which indications? There are good data from a large inceptional cohort study called FINISH, or FINICE, as the primary author was Italian, Maurizio Cicconi. Run in the spring of 2013 by the European Society of Intensive Care Medicine. Many ICUs in many primary European countries participated. The detailed registration of the 2,300 patients who received a fluid bolus in the ICU on that day. These patients had sepsis, cardiac failure, were respiratory cases, fairly sick patients, SOFA score 7, majority on mechanical ventilations. So these are the indications that the clinicians marked on that specific day why they choose to give a fluid bolus to these patients. And as you see, this covers the vast majority of indications for a fluid bolus. A lot about hypertension or weaning of vasopressor, oliguria, and lactate. I guess it's not directly obvious that these indications should fit our physiological model of Frank Starling's left heart lower, and that therefore, if we by physiology give fluid to these indications, there has to be some middle equations that may be difficult to follow. Maybe a relevant question is that does fluid help on the short term for these indications? Does it improve the presumed circulatory problems described by these cases? Until this year, there has been no randomized data to answer this question. Now we have data from the randomized trial classic. Again, I'll present it in a bit more detail. Showing data on the first 24 hours after randomization in a group that had standard care fluid therapy and one that was restricted. So no more resuscitation fluid in principle in the restricted group, standard care in the other group. And here you see the physiological parameters, they do not differ. So at least in this trial, to give IV fluids for these, our main indications, hypertension, lactate, urinary output, did not change the physiological marker. I think it's a bit sad that we have to wait until 2017 to have randomized data on this, our core intervention. But that's how it is. This concept of the Frank Starling law and that fluid therapy is the corner of resuscitation was, I guess, written directly into a very influential protocol of sepsis resuscitation, the Emmanuel Rivas trial on early goal-directed therapy. There you see the protocol. First, you optimize preload, in this case by targeting central venous pressure. First, after you've done that, you can optimize blood pressure by vasopressor, and if the patient is still in trouble, then you can use an inotrope. So this very influential protocol, again, highlighting that fluid therapy has been the corner of our resuscitation strategy for many years, and probably this concept of Frank Starling's law. And in the gold ring therapy trial, the initial one at least, did result in more fluid given, and as you all know, the outcome of the patients was remarkable, a marked reduction in mortality. And I think this trial underlined the, for me at least, the importance of IV fluid therapy, and I think formed our continuous, quite liberal practice. Well, all good stories have an end. So three very large trials performed on three continents, multi-center now, thousands and thousands of patients, higher fluid volumes given on all the three early goal-directed therapy arms in this trial compared to control. Absolutely no difference in mortality. So what was and appeared for at least for a decade to be a confirmation that IV fluid therapy has to be central in resuscitation, at least of patients with sepsis, was now somewhat challenged. It gets worse, actually, because there are no clean RCTs of IV fluid therapies for patients with sepsis. There is a very large and well-performed one in kids. The FEAST trial, done by an extremely talented and pleasant colleague, Kat Maitland. So the FEAST trial, it's a randomized trial of no fluid bolus versus saline fluid bolus versus albumin bolus. So a three-arm trial in 3,000 kids in Africa with fever and impaired circulation, as assessed clinically, very simple. The trial was stopped early because of increased mortality in the two fluid bolus arms. So, said another way, those who did not receive fluid bolus have improved survival. So this is by far the best fluid volume trial done, and it indicates clear harm with our standard therapy. I think that's a problem. You hear at meetings and in the endoscopic sepsis campaign guideline, and mostly of intensivists who look after adult patients in a ICU in the Western world, they would say, these kids, they had malaria, they were severely anemic, this cannot be representative for our patient in a modern Western ICU. But this is the subgroup analysis made depending on you had malaria or not, if you had severe anemia or not, if you have a higher or lower lactate, if higher or lower base deficit, if you had coma or not. And I see no points crossing the line to favor IV fluid therapy. They are all on the side of harm. So there are data in that trial to say no, it appears not to be dependent on malaria or severe anemia or lesser or more severe disease. So I think this is a problem that cannot go away. In spite of all this, the majority of the guideline group in the surviving sepsis campaign recently voted again and renewed basically their recommendation for fluid therapy, which is a strong recommendation for a fixed dose, 30 ml. Don't think, just give 30 ml per kilo for patients with septic shock. As you see, there's a strong recommendation in spite of low quality evidence, which is a bad mismatch. This is mandated, and you probably know that it's now mandated by law, both in the United States and in Holland, that this should be followed. If not, you're a bad doctor and may go to jail. Maybe not, but. And the second part on ongoing fluid therapy, we recommend the fluid channel technique be applied where fluid administration is continued as long as hemodynamic factors improve. This is the top of the Starling curve. So a very simplified physiological model still rules And now it's called a best practice statement, which is kind of a funny word because there are no evidence to support this. Previous iteration of the guideline, it was ungraded because there's absolutely no evidence. Now they call it best practice statement. Strange words for something that is without any evidence. So fluid resuscitation in sepsis, I think it's fair to say that the circulatory failure in sepsis is very, very complex. Obviously, the vasodilation is a hallmark for some patients. Impaired pump function is a hallmark for other patients. But so just to say 30 ml of fluid fixed, I think is a extreme simplification. I would state that the majority of these patients, they have never lost a drop of blood. But we apply an intervention that was originally designed to substitute loss. And I think it builds an extremely simplified physiological model. The Frank-Starling law of the heart is the highest ruling law among anesthesiologists. So kidney physiology or coagulation physiology or even right-sided heart physiology, venous return function physiology rules lower. And therefore, we still promote fluid. As I showed you, there are no proven benefit of this standard intervention in trials, and there is indirect evidence of harm. Still, it's promoted in guidelines. So this was the basis for what the classic trial, which first was a feasibility trial, because we wanted to restrict resuscitation volumes in patients with septic shock, but we thought it was so difficult to ask anesthetists and intensivists to stop giving fluid, so we had to do a feasibility trial to see that it was feasible with the protocol we designed. So multicenter trial done in Denmark and Finland, published in November in Intensive Care Medicine results. As said, multicenter randomized feasibility trial. We randomized patients with septic shock who were in the ICU and who had received the initial fixed dose of 30 ml per kilo. We thought it was probably too challenging in the first trial to include patients very early on. So some fluids given, randomized to a protocol restricting fluid or a protocol aiming at standard care. So the patient had to have no adrenaline running to maintain a blood pressure. Those who were randomized to restriction were to have no more fluid for resuscitation unless bad circulatory things happened. And these are the bad stuff. So severe lactatemia, so that's 4 or above. Severe hypotension in spite of noradrenaline, so mean arterial pressure below 50. Mottling beyond the edge of the kneecap, so that's a mottling score of 3 or above. And severe oliguria. But only in the first 2 hours. Some of these patients will not pee for 3 or 4 weeks. We didn't want clinicians to drown these patients because then it's our impression they fell really bad. So oliguria was only an indication for fluid in the first 2 hours after randomization, then no more. The standard care arm was aiming to mimic the surviving sepsis campaign guidelines, so that is isotonic crystalloids could be given as long as hemodynamics values improve and you can choose whatever variable you want. In both groups, replacements of overt losses were allowed, but do not use colloids in either group. We didn't want the restriction group to receive a lot of albumin, whereas the standard care group could receive a lot of crystalloids. So no colloids. Fluid was not mandated in either of these protocols, but it could be given. We screened 200 patients to randomize 150 and analyzed 99%. Had two co-primary outcomes, and it was a feasibility trial. It was volumes of IV fluids given in the first 5 days. This is the first one, so marked difference between the two groups. median 1500 milliliters, and volumes of resuscitation fluid during the entire ICU stay. Again, marked differences with the same median difference. Here depicted as percentiles in the two groups, you can see that in the fluid restriction group, more than one third of the patient never received more resuscitation fluid. There was, however, no statistical significant difference between total fluid volumes or fluid balances, and there were no differences between serious adverse reactions to either crystalloids or noradrenaline in the trial. We encouraged protocol violations. We wanted, this was a feasibility trial, we wanted to see where are the problems. So these are the protocol violations in the restricted arms. So a third of the patients had violations, mainly if fluids given on other indication that the classic criteria, vasal pressure, lactate that was not elevated before, oliguria beyond the first 2 hours, and then, a bit surprisingly, heart rate. You saw this already. These are the physiological variables in the first 24 hours. I just put the numbers there. Estimated mean differences between these physiological variables between the two groups. There are no differences. So this extra fluid they received did not result in immediate circulatory improvement. Actually, it resulted in nothing. There was no change in lactate, noradrenaline dose, or urinary output between the two groups. We had exploratory outcomes, but obviously the trial was not powered for this. Mortality, ischemic events, worsening of acute kidney injury. As you see, the point estimates, they all favor fluid restriction, and kidney worsening of kidney failure was statistically significant. Which I guess was somewhat surprising, but there are physiological data to explain this. It shouldn't be a surprise that we can use kidney injury by giving IV fluids. We've just always prioritized the Frank-Starling-Lohr, not kidney physiology. Also, there is data from a systematic review on a bit later in the phase, so conservative fluid management, de-resuscitation strategies, following resuscitation in critically ill patients. And there are now a fair number of patients randomized. This is the mortality data in ARDS. See, the point estimate favor conservative fluid. Sepsis or serious, point estimate favor conservative fluids. Mixed sepsis and ARDS, point estimate favors conservative. Overall point estimate obviously favors conservative fluid or de-resuscitation strategies after initial resuscitation. 2,000 patients, not statistically significant. Ventilatory 3 days, statistically significant, fewer ventilatory 3 days in the liberal arm. So, I think we're in the middle zone with fluid resuscitation. Is there a safe volume? What are the triggers? What are the targets we should use? It's obvious that there are increasing evidence of harm from IV fluid therapy. And I think it's fair to say that these trials are urgently needed. I think until we have results of these trials, we should really, really reconsider some of our routine practices that we have employed by tradition to give maintenance, IV fluid for keeping drips open, IV fluid for forced diuresis, medication, electrolyte substitutions. The likelihood that these has benefit is, in my opinion, extremely low. The potential for harm is obvious. A few words on types of fluid. Crystalloid versus colloids, this will be very short. When I went to school, I was told that I could save one third of the volume by using a colloid. We now know for the blinded trial that this is not the case. For blinded trials, comparing crystalloid with a colloid, the ratios, when clinicians do not know what they give, ranged from hardly any difference to 1.4 in the safe drive with albumin. So if anything, if there is a fluid sparing effect of using Coloix, it's minor. More importantly, the question of benefit versus harm. I've been part of a guideline group writing a Scandinavian clinical practice guideline on colloid versus crystalloids, and it's quite simple. We recommend that you use crystalloids rather than colloids for the vast majority of critical patients. Maybe a more interesting question, and at least one where we'll see data coming soon, is if we should use buffered crystalloids or saline. It's obvious that none of these fluids, they match plasma water. We don't want to pay for a bicarbonate containing IV fluid. There are limited data from high quality trial. There are a lot of data like this, sort of emotional based promotion of who wants the injection of all these chips into their veins with normal saline. I like Sean Bergshaw, who made this slide a lot, but I think this is not helpful. This is emotional based medicine. Because the largest trial done until now, and by far the best trial, is a split trial, saline versus an acetate buffered crystalloid called Plasmolite in 2,000 ICU patients. It was a cluster randomized trial, so 2,000 patients sounds like a lot. It is not in a cluster randomized trial. Primary outcome, occurrence of kidney failure, absolutely no difference. No difference in the use of renal replacement therapy. So the best bit now is there are no differences between these two foods regarding AKI. As I said, no fluid match plasma water. So it will be a choice between giving a higher load of chloride or a higher load of some buffer, being it lactate, acetate, even gluconate or malate. I don't know why they put gluconate or malate into these fluids, but they do. So you're injecting 5 or 10 millimoles of gluconate and malate and 20 millimoles of acetate into a severely sick patient. Why? What does it do? No one knows. And there is a risk of hyponatremia with the buffer solution, as shown in the Cochrane meta-analysis of this subject. So, they are drugs. I think colloids are without obvious benefit. I think you can use crystalloids. I use both saline and a buffer solution. We both have their indications for the right patient for the right time. It's okay, I think, to give fluid for severe hyperperfusion, but do not do it again if it doesn't help. If it doesn't help, clear side effects. As said, reconsider all those strange indications that we use IV fluids for. We really, really need this large trial, probably several large trials. This will be an international collaboration. There are Swedish investigators we met this morning and discuss the protocol. I'll just share some of our thoughts about how to restrict fluid therapy, and maybe we could discuss this. Proposed inclusion criteria will be that patients has received 2 liters. So again, it is not 2 liters in 2 minutes. It is not a no fluid trial. And then the restriction will be no more IV fluids given at all, unless this happens. Severe hyperperfusion, same criteria as in the pilot. If you have documented loss, not perceived loss, documented loss, then you can give fluid. If you have GI failure and therefore cannot give fluid down the tube, and you need rehydration or electrolytes, or your total fluid input for that day is less than 1 liter, then you can give IV fluid in measured amounts, and only in measured amounts. No maintenance, no open drip, no forced diuresis, no fluid for IV dye contrast. So this is, I guess, the present suggestion for a protocol, and I would like to use 5 minutes to discuss this.
You're done?
Yeah.
I know this has a taxi coming here 7 o'clock, so we have 10 minutes to discuss. There must be several questions. 5 minutes. Okay. Please, and speak up. Yes.
Thank you for a brilliant presentation with a very, very clear message, I would say. Concerning this protocol, I think maybe the most problematic part of it would be the blood pressure. I think people would be very afraid of keeping patients on 52 and MAP, and it's against the current guidelines and so forth. So that would be a problem. Maybe the lactate would be okay, maybe the urinary output, but I think the blood pressure would be a concern to my clinicians.
Noradrenaline is an excellent drug to keep up blood pressure.
But if you come up, if you use it on your achieving blood pressure, that's right, but when you come up in blood, in norepinephrine dosages, that might be a concern for some of us, I think.
Sure, and as you saw, the protocol violations in the restrictive arm, basal pressure dose was the number one reason to violate this protocol.
Yes.
I think we have some support now with weak data of the pilot that there's some safety with this protocol, that we are not killing patients.
I think one of the problems is the fact that we live in a time now when everything should be very dry, but simultaneously you should not give too much catecholamines due to the intoxication and the harm you give from them. So this is a very conflicting time to be with an intensivist.
It's not easy.
Almost. Yeah, on that part, I have a question. Have you considered if you sort of, you might easily imagine that you reach above 0.3 micrograms per kilo per minute noradrenaline in these patients. Have you any protocol for using vasopressin?
I haven't used it for 10 years. I think 4.3 is probably a sort of a random mark, I would say. So in my mind, there is probably no upper limit for noradrenaline. And on the other hand, giving fluids, as you saw, the physiological data from Classic didn't appear to either increase blood pressure or reduce the dose of noradrenaline. So one, I think vasopressin, I would like to see it work in a randomized trial before recommending it, so probably not. Two, giving more fluids to patients with higher vasopressor dose. Maybe in any trial, clinicians should be allowed to make the judgment and break the protocol, but my expectations that it would help with the first randomized data for Classic is low. I mean, there was 0.01 mic in difference between the restrictive and the liberal arm in the pilot. So fluid may not be the answer to higher vasopressor dose.
Final question then.
Does it matter how fast you give the fluid?
Really good question. No one knows, I think.
I can say that kinetically you should slow it down, definitely. There are some evidence for that. All right, now we have used the 5 minutes, so Jenny, please.
So now, applause.